Zahra El Arifi is the internationally best-selling author of The Final Strife and The Battle Drum, the first two installments of the Ending Fire trilogy, inspired by her Ghanaian and Sudanese heritage. She has lived in many countries, had many jobs, and owned many more cats. After a decade of working in marketing and communications, she returned to academia to complete a master's degree in African studies alongside her writing career. El Arifi knew she was a storyteller from the moment she told her first lie. Over the years, she has perfected her tall tales into epic ones. She currently resides in London as a full-time procrastinator, and today we talk about Feybound, her new fantasy novel that comes out January 23rd. I hope you enjoy this fun and casual conversation. Happy reading! Hi, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Professional Book Nerds podcast. Emma here, and today I'm very excited to have this author on. We have Zahra El Arifi to talk about Feybound. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Welcome. I'm so happy to have you here to talk about what is one of my most anticipated books of the entire year.
Oh my God.
Feybound. So for our listeners, this book comes out on January 23rd in the United States, January 18th in the UK. So not too long to wait now.
Yeah, crazy. I don't know where the year's gone.
It's very exciting. And so for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about what to expect in Feybound?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because you always get, as an author, even though I've been doing this for so many years, I always get stumped by that question. I'm like, what are these books about? I've been writing for years. So let me attempt to. Feybound is about two sisters who get captured by the Fae. The Fae in their world has not really existed outside of history books. They pretty much thought the Fae had gone extinct. And it is a fated mates, enemies to lovers, a lot of lovers. it's just been the biggest joy writing about Fae and mixing together the cultures that I grew up in a new and unique way. And I've just loved it, and hopefully readers do too.
I can only speak for myself, but I will say that every chapter I read of this book, it was like, it just made me smile. And every like thing that was revealed that I won't mention, I was just like either extremely happy or just in shock.
Yeah, I love twists. And I think people who've read my earlier work have got to this. I don't even try and do it, but there's like almost like a three twist structure that I always have. I have one twist that I always kind of lay the breadcrumbs for that I really want readers to like know and figure out, because I want them to feel like, you know, you got one. And then I have another twist that's a little bit more obscure that, you know, some readers who are really clever will figure out. And then I'll have one that is just so left field that very few people figure out.
Yes. Yes. I'm like, we may have to chat about this off recording for spoilers, but there, I love that though, where there's like breadcrumbs sort of peppered throughout and then a few that are a little bit trickier to figure out.
Yeah.
So where did the idea for this first book, this is a new trilogy, right?
Yeah, it is. I hadn't even actually finished the first trilogy that I was writing, and this concept just came to me, this like magical kind of drums. I was thinking, that's a really interesting magical concept, like drum magic. And then I thought, imagine if that drum was made with a magical beast skin. And that's from the skin, from the drum skin is like where the magic is most potent. And so then I started thinking about the beasts that would make up the drum skin. Pretty morbid. But then and then the world just started to unravel. And I was like, wow, okay, this is something that I absolutely have to explore. And I remember kind of filing it away in my brain with the many other book concepts that I have bubbling away there. And before even The Final Strife came out in 2022, my editor said to me, have you got another idea? Because, you know, we're really interested. We can see that The Final Strife is getting a lot of buzz. We're really interested in like continuing our partnership. And I was like, guys, my first book's not even out yet. And they said, you know, can you tell me anything? And I said, I think the exact phrase I said was black thirsty elves with drum magic. And then and I saw my editor's face and she's like, this sounds amazing. And I was, and she was like, can you write me up a sample? And I was like, but I've got some other books to write first. She was like, no, do it, please. We're really interested. And yeah, and I just wrote it, and I wrote it so quickly. And like the whole novel, I think, took me from first page to the last page, the first draft, which is always absolute rubbish. But the first rubbish draft, it took me about 6 weeks from the first word to the last period.
Wow. So yeah, but yeah, everything just like really came to you.
Yeah, because it's really interesting because I only have, when I'm kind of coming up with a concept, I just have concepts. I don't have anything beyond like drum magic, elves. I knew the fae and humans were going to be other two beings. I knew there was going to be this magical beast, but I had no sense of plot. And so I have to write to figure out the plot. And so this just came to me really quickly. And I often tidy up, and my edits are huge, like massive edits. I think The Final Strife started off at 300 pages and ended up at like 650 pages. So it was like a real, like my edits are huge. And because I have no idea of plot when I'm starting it, so I have to like get to the end to go, okay, now you need to absolutely rewrite everything. So yeah, it did. Feyban definitely came to me really quickly.
But I love that that's your process. And I do love asking authors that, because it's so different for every single person, just sort of how you work through a story and the characters. And so that was another question I had, is like, how did all of the pieces of the world building sort of come together? I mean, there's magic here, there's fae, elves, there's a lot of mythology. There's like the three gods, we have the magical beasts. There's just a lot of different elements. How does all of that sort of start to take shape?
Yeah, so I think for me, is I work at the world building in each edit. So Feyban didn't actually go through that many edits, but when I start the first draft is just like plot, just like who is who. And then in the next edit, I start to piece together the smaller details. So for me, it's all about building up that iceberg of like world building. So the reader sees the tip and, you know, I have everything else under the surface. And so a lot of what I do in my planning stages is like, I know the culture and the, so there's four different districts in Feybound, Eclipse, Crescent, Waning and Waxing. So those are the four based on the moon, obviously. So in those kind of four districts, I have built the culture, the politics, the environment. I know that it might be a throwaway line in Feybound. It's like, it might even just be one word, but I have built up that whole system. And I think, that definitely comes during edits. And a lot of it, I lent on my own culture, my own, upbringing. So I'm Ghanaian, Sydneyese and British, but I was raised in the Middle East and Sheffield in the UK. So I have a lot of different kind of cultures influencing me. I talk about food a lot in all my books, and it's because like food has been such a staple of the way that I was raised, because one day I would have like mulahia, which is an Arabic dish, and then the next day I'd have fufu, which is a Ghanaian dish, and the day after that I'd have fish and chips. So I'm so lucky that I have that kind of well of culture to just dive into and to borrow from, to build these new worlds, which is really fun.
I love that. And so you mentioned that the very first draft of this took about 6 weeks. What is your ideal writing setup sort of during that time? Like, do you have to be in a particular spot? Like, do you have music, no music? What is your setup to write these books?
This is quite funny, and I don't actually think I've said this publicly anywhere, but Feybound was mainly written in the bath. So I have like a wooden plank that I put across the bath, and I put my laptop on it, and I will sit there And Feyban was, yeah, I'd say easily 80% of it was written in the bath. And I will sit there for like 4 hours. Like the water will have gone cold and I will still be typing away. And I don't know why, but for me, that was where I had to write Feyban. The final strife and the battle drum and the ending fire, actually, I all wrote at my desk because I have a desk. I don't need to write in the bath. And then I think actually elements of the ending fire, I kind of got stifled by my study. I don't know why. I was just like, my office is not working for me today. And that was done on the sofa. But I also kind of do really well writing when I'm traveling. So if I'm on long train journeys, on flights, often on the tube, so the underground in London, if I'm going, because anywhere in London, if you want to travel, it's a minimum 45 minute journey. So I just get my phone out and I use the Notes app and I write a bunch of words. And I normally can do like, if I'm in the flow, I can do like 45 minutes, probably like 1,000 words. And then I copy and paste it into Word. I use every single second that I can. And then actually there'll be some days where, you know, the whole 12 hours, I can only get 700 words out. And but then I have to trust myself that the next day I'll manage to like make it up somehow. But yeah, it's generally chaos when I write. I don't listen to any music. I drink a lot of tea. And yeah, silence is the only way I can do it.
Okay. But I love that you sort of go where it ebbs and flows and that there are some places where it just works and others where it doesn't, and that it changes depending on what you're working on.
Yeah, absolutely. It was so funny that Feyban just required a bath. I had to be in water.
Sounds like the ideal setup though.
Oh, it's pretty great. Yeah, it's pretty great.
And now correct me if I'm saying any of the characters' names incorrectly. Always tricky with fantasy. So we have two sisters that we follow for the bulk of the book, Yiren and Lettle.
Yeah, Yiren and Lettle. It's funny, you talk about pronunciation. And so when you do the audiobooks, I just have to talk about it because pronunciation for me is a nightmare as well. Because when you're writing, you don't often think about how it sounds. And when you do audiobooks, you have to send a whole bunch of like pronunciation guides. And sometimes it's the first time I'm saying that word out loud. And I'm like, I just made this up. Or it's a derivative of an Arabic word that doesn't sound like this anymore. So yeah, I struggle with pronunciation as well.
Well, and I think as a reader of fantasy, sometimes I just like sort of gloss it over in my head, you know, because you're like, I'm not quite sure about this, but I know who it is. And we're just going to. And so then when I have to ask authors the question, I'm like, wait, do I know how to say this at all?
And I speak. Yeah.
But yeah, so we have two sisters. Their dynamic as sisters, you know, and siblings is heartwarming, but it's also complex. So what made you want to write about specifically their sister dynamic?
So I'm an elder sister. And for me, I just think there's something so special about the silly little, like no matter how old I am, no matter that I'm in my mid-30s, when I'm with my sister, I turn into a child. We start, you know, laughing and doing silly things, but also from an argument perspective, some of our arguments are just so silly and stupid. And I thought that's a really interesting dynamic, like the way that you love this person so deeply, but you can also hate them very much in a way that's not, you know, it's surface level hate. It's in that moment my sister can make me angrier than anyone in the world. And yet I love her so much and I will do anything for her. And I thought, right, I need to explore this in like a much wilder setting, in a more explosive way, where there are things like war going on and people are prisoners and things like that. And for me, it was pushing that sisterly bond to the limit and seeing what would happen. And I just, I really love that. There's a line in the book, which is the scars of their life fused them together. And I think that's so true about sisters, like you, or siblings at all. You don't choose each other, but you are forever ingrained in each other's lives. And I think, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be built on trauma, but I think there is something really interesting about exploring that trauma that you've been through with someone. And so Yiren Lettle came to me.
Yeah, and I like that the through line though of the story is Right, that they sort of have their issues. They know how to press each other's buttons almost immediately, but you can sort of see how much they do care for one another, and that sort of love when everything comes, you know, to potentially harm them, they're each other's first advocate.
Absolutely.
Without revealing anything at all about what happens. But I also think it's really interesting, like they can remember certain things as siblings totally differently.
Yeah.
So the way that you remember certain experiences, and I think you touch on this a little bit from each of their perspective, they describe the same exact thing, but with slightly different twist.
Yeah.
And I think that's really fascinating.
And that's definitely borrowed from my own experiences. You know, I think one of the scenarios in which they remember things differently is that I think Lettle screams in a clearing and scares away a creature that her Yiren and her father were trying to hunt. And so Yiren's memory of it is that Lettle ruined that hunt, and Lettle remembers Yiren running towards her and ruined that hunt. So their perspectives, they both blame each other. And I think that's so interesting. I love playing with how people see things differently, even though like the facts of it were both the same. The blame and the experience was different. And I think that's really fascinating.
Exactly. How you can just sort of twist it a little bit to sort of what you remember. It might not be the exact same as your siblings. Now, the title of the book is Feybound. We learn what that means in the context of the story. When did the title of this book become Feybound, or was it always?
Okay, no. So... I don't think I've spoken about this publicly either. So it was originally, and I have to preface with the fact that every title I've ever chosen has been changed. Everyone has always hated a title I've chosen. So I kind of choose them knowing they're going to change. And at this stage, my agent didn't even let it get to my editor. She was like, no. And so the original title was Glory Bound. And my agent was like, no, it just sounds either like a self-help book or something about S&M. So I think maybe not. And so the second version was Beast Bound, which I liked, but gave a different connotation to Feybound. I think Feybound is softer, immediately draws those people who read particularly fey books will know straight away, okay, it's Feybound, it's a fey book. And so from a marketing perspective, I totally understood why they preferred Feybound. But I had a three book, it's like a kind of construct. I had like, it was going to be Beastbound was going to be book one, and then Feybound was going to be book two, and then Thricebound was going to be book three. And all of that is not the case anymore. So that's totally been changed. So we'll see what they decide book two is going to be called. I wait with bated breath. I've no idea because, yeah, honestly, I'm terrible with titles.
No, and so I love the title Feybound, and certainly in the context of the book, what it means to the characters.
Yeah, absolutely.
And of course, it looks gorgeous on the cover of the book as well.
I know, so. The cover is so gorgeous. I love it.
It's so good. And just because we're talking about it, I do love talking about covers because obviously we say don't judge a book by the cover, but it is something that intrigues us or catches our eye. How did the cover sort of come to be for this?
Oh, it's this is stunning. I love it. It's probably one of my favorite covers I've ever actually seen on any book ever. And it was one of the most difficult processes, not from my perspective. I'm fairly easygoing when it comes to, you know, they pitch me ideas. I'm like, great, let's try this. Let's see. But I think we had 12 concepts in March last year, and all of them got ditched because within the process of marketing and sales, no one could agree. And so I think all 12 of them ended up being ditched. And then we briefed in an illustrator, and it was the same kind of concept of what we had now, but my editor wasn't fully happy with it. And I think she was entirely right. I think the style wasn't right. And then she found this illustrator, so Joe Wilson, and So by this point, we're now in like October last year. So it was a really late release cover because we'd gone through so many iterations. But I'm so glad because at the end of the day, we got like the most incredible cover. So I'm just so happy. And I just love it. It's so evocative. It's like romantic, but also quite like crimsony. I don't know. It gives me lots of feelings and I love it.
It does. And you actually got quite a few really cool cover editions.
Yes.
with this. So like there's the Waterstones edition, yes. The Goldsboro one, which was stunning. And then the Fairy Loot as well, right?
Yeah. So I've been very, very lucky to have some amazing editions. So I call the kind of main edition the Midnight Edition because it's midnight. Yeah. And then we have the Fairy Loot Edition, which is Dawn, which is blue and it's got a sun, so it's slightly different illustration. And then the Goldsboro, which is Twilight. And yeah, I'm just so lucky. They're just amazing and all different sprayed edges. It's just, yeah, really lucky.
I love that. I love the sprayed edges. It's always like a nice added touch. So to have a gorgeous cover and the edge.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Now, going back to the content of the book a little bit, in the story, we have these magical creatures, which I don't think is a spoiler to mention them.
No. Obia. Yeah.
And they represent very different things. We find out to the elves and to the fae. And so I'm wondering where that idea, you know, for these creatures and for their role with these different elves and fae sort of came from.
Yeah. So Obia as a concept is actually a West African magic system. And it was something that I've always been really intrigued about and with. And while I was doing my master's in African studies, which I completed last year, which I just did for fun while I'm writing many, many books, but it was fun. I was really intrigued and interested in this kind of West African magic system that still really exists in the world. And I'd seen in Ghana and, you know, some of my aunties and, you know, it could be something as small as if their left knee kind of twinges, they think it's going to rain. Do you know what I mean? It could be as small as that, or it could be as big as I'm going to predict your death. And so I'm really interested in Obia. And I started looking at it as kind of a justice-based magic system. I thought, that's really interesting. So what would a creature look like if it was made out of this system that's so vast and so wide, you know, it's wide-ranging across the world? What would it look like? And I just started building this creature of the things I loved. So I was like, okay, I want massive stag antlers, and then I want the body of a leopard. And I just think that that's so, it feels both, in a lot of ways, it's the pieces of me. It's like meeting the West, the North meets the South, you know. It's like the African and the Asian, and then also the European, you know. It feels really interesting, and I could probably write an essay about it. I won't, because I don't have to do that anymore, thankfully. But I think it is really interesting, this creature that kind of came out of my imagination imagination based on these debates I was having with myself. And then kind of putting them into a very awful situation where they're being hunted for their skin to make drums or to be fletchlings on arrows and things like that. Because they are innately magic, and they're the only creature within the elf world that has magic. And so that's where they kind of fuel their weapons for war. The way the fae kind of interact with them is very different. And that's more on the verging of spoilers. So I won't talk about that, but I think, I love the way, like, just turning certain things, you know, you think something is one thing, but it's actually very much not. And yeah, I think that's a twist that I love in the book. And it's not necessarily a twist, but I think it's a very big plot point. And Pila is probably one of my favorite characters that I've ever written.
She's fantastic. Yeah. And I do love, though, that this sort of creature came out of a lot of different things for you and part of just your imagination. Because I think sometimes, you know, fantasy stories rely on other, you know, mythological references or things like that. So when I was reading this, I was like Googling, like, is this real? Is this, what is this?
Yeah.
And it's so cool, you know, where you drew the inspiration from and then sort of let imagination take over.
Oh yeah, that is like, that for me is basically how I work. I will start with the seeds of maybe something that exists, the tiniest seed of something. And then my mind will just take it so much further than it ever needs to go.
But I love that. And that's why, you know, we have these wonderful books to read and sort of take us to new places that we just would not expect to be. You mentioned in this story that prophecy. And so prophecy plays a large part in a lot of things that we see in Feybound.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly, and our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.
I'm interested to know why you think Lettle is so drawn to knowing all of the things she can about the future, when sort of a big part of prophecy is that you can't necessarily do anything to change it.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. It's kind of, it's the control freak within me that exists in Lettle. And it's this idea that if you know it, you can change it. Not that you can change it, but if you know it, that you have a sense of control. And I think one of the ways that she explains it is prophecy will, you know, for example, tell you that there's a drought coming in 2 weeks. Now, if you know that, you can put a bucket out now to collect rainwater. And I think that kind of level of control allows her to, yeah, just make sense of the world, because she's had such a rough upbringing. I think Lettle's consistently trying to have power over things that she just can't and hasn't ever in her life. And the way that divination kind of works in the world is that, again, because magic only comes from the obvious, you have to, God, it's so brutal. You have to read the entrails of the creatures. So entrail reading is something that, you know, has existed for millennia and is something that I did a lot of research into, but then again, the seed of it, and I took it further. And I think, yeah, the way that, so that's something that's, Lettle sees herself as diviner, so that's something that she does. She will read entrails to come up with prophecy. And I think it is 100% about control, and it is, yeah, her trying to make sense of everything going on around her.
And she does spend a good, again, it's so hard, I don't want to spoil anything, but she does sort of spend a good amount of time at the book, I think, trying to control things that she can't.
Yes,
as we often do.
Yeah, and I think once you have a prophecy that's told about you, because it's really rare for you to kind of receive a prophecy about yourself, I think you want to change it, even though she knows that she can't. And it's something that she, you know, there's, I'm writing book two at the moment, and she's still resisting a lot of prophecy. And even though it's there, it's written in stone, it's like she absolutely doesn't want to believe it. And I think because it's almost, even though prophecy isn't necessarily word-based, it's like a feeling, like they translate it into language when they're reading, which is part of the experience of divination. There is it is still open to interpretation. And I think that is something that for her is like, well, what if it's wrong? Even though it's not, and it has never been.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's always that slight possibility or maybe hope that it could be incorrect.
Exactly.
You did mention at the start of our conversation that some of the elements in this book include fated mates, include enemies to lovers. So there are a lot of sort of romantic interests for characters in this story. Did you know going in sort of how you wanted those romantic interactions to sort of play out? And how did all of those come to be?
So yes, definitely. I knew that there was going to be a sapphic relationship from the get-go. I knew even in writing the sample, I was like, okay, well, Euron is gay. That was just automatically came out. Most of my characters are queer in some way or another. And then I also knew that there was going to be this more, I guess, typically heterosexual relationship that was going to be fated mates. And those two, just kind of playing those two relationships in different perspectives, was so much fun. And that was always going to be the way I was always leaning with Feybound, was more towards like the romancy genre, whereas like The Final Strife for me was a really kind of raw and unflinching portrayal of identity and loss, and something that I was experiencing as writing the final, when I was writing The Final Strife. So I always say that kind of like The Final Strife is very much me representing Black pain, whereas Feybound is Black joy. And I think both are so important, so important. But Feybound was just went in that direction. And yeah, I was absolutely having the time of my life with those romantic relationships. And just, you know, it's always going to be awkward writing sex scenes. And you know, more than one, and having multiple people edit them and multiple people copy edit them and have opinions on them. But do you know what? I was just like, yes, it is strange thinking my mum is currently reading it, but you know, it's fine. I think they've seen worse. My mum said to me once, I skipped all the violence in The Final Strife. I was like, well, then what did you read if you skipped all the violence? So she's probably going to skip all the sex in Feybound. So we'll see.
I think as someone that reads a good amount of romance and romanticy, I think all of the scenes were very, very, very well done.
Thank you very much. That means a lot.
In just one person's opinion. And it's so subjective in what, you know, what you sort of enjoy or are looking for in those sorts of scenes. But
yeah.
It can be tricky, but I think it was very well. I don't want to say it was very tastefully done, but it was.
Thank you. The
language was lovely.
Thank you. There was a lot of discussion. So I basically workshopped as many words as I could with a lot of my writer friends. And we were all sitting down. I remember we were actually in a cafe as well. So this was in public. I was like, so shall I use this word? And everyone was like, no, not that one. So it was basically sex scenes written by an entire room full of fantasy authors.
In a cafe with fans. But that's fantastic, though, because I do think you try to get creative with how you're going to write it, or you sort of determine what level of, you know, I don't want to say explicitness, but like how you want to go into it or not.
Absolutely, yeah. And I knew I wanted to go all in. But then there was like certain phrases that I was like, I just don't want to use that phrase. It takes me out of it. So yeah, that was tricky. But you know what? So much fun.
Exactly. But it, very well done.
Thank you.
Just everything just seemed to flow really nicely together in the setting, in the story, in the world building. I really enjoyed the relationships between these characters as you sort of see the things develop. It was just fantastic.
Thank you. That means a lot.
You're so welcome. And now there are so many cool elements to this. I'm already like just eagerly awaiting book two, and book one is not out yet, but there's also a fair amount of sort of political court intrigue that happens in the story. There's obviously a war happening in the elven world. So there's all of those politics as well. I'm interested in how you sort of crafted all of those different like political layers because it seems like most people are trying to achieve the same thing, but a lot of other elements are getting in the way. Again, without giving too much away, but just how did you approach sort of adding all of those different political layers?
So I think it comes actually quite naturally to me to kind of have like a political or almost like military kind of setting or background. And definitely when I first wrote the first draft of Feybound was about double the length of time in the elven world before they went to the Fey realm. And I think that that was all down to me world building and setting up for book two, which rightfully my editors were like, we don't actually need to know what's happening in, you know, Waxing or Crescent right now. We just need to know what's happening in Waning, which is Euron and Letel's district, and then move to the Fey realm, which absolutely they were right. You know, I was wasting time there because I knew that I had this backstory that I needed for book two and three. And when I build those kind of political systems, I look at the real world. That's what's really sad. It's like, I look at how the real world is built. I look at the wars that are going on. And I think, and fundamentally you get to the crux of it and you're like, God, this is so stupid. Like, why is this happening? And I almost wanted that feeling when I was writing Feybound, like exasperation with like, why is there so much violence where it just doesn't really make sense? And unfortunately, that's a mirror to our real world. But I do kind of set up, okay, this is the political views of this world. This is this district. This is who's aligning with this one, even though it's not, you know, again, it will be mentioned like for a second in the book. I need that there so I know that, you know, that world is fully formed. And then when it came to the Fey realm, I can't go into too much detail because, again, it's a spoiler, but I think I wanted to really examine the way people can be indoctrinated in different ways and have, even though they're raised within the same family, have totally different views or, yeah, I think I'll leave it at that, but that was how I kind of examined the political nature of the Fey realm.
It's so true though, where seemingly you have some of these figures where their mission is the same, but other things seem to be getting in the way that don't quite make sense.
It's so frustrating, and it's so frustrating. And it was definitely, that was something that I wanted to explore.
Absolutely. And so sort of similarly, you know, a lot of readers will turn to the fantasy genre as a little bit of an escape from reality or from the real world, but certainly books can be a really good tool for learning. And so how do you sort of incorporate those real life lessons into that fantasy setting or that fantasy story?
Yeah, I think I've always kind of revolve around things like identity politics. For me, that is something that's really important to me, although there isn't necessarily racism or oppression in the same way in Feybound as there is in The Final Strife, which is quite clear cut. It is something that I really want to explore and always have kind of, you know, there are different races here. And although, you know, racism doesn't exist in the same way, there are differences that are perceived to be bad things. Or, you know, the Fae are vilified in history and we don't actually know what happened, things like that. And I think I love the queer normativity and I just wish our world looked like that. And I think sometimes fantasy writers, not all the time, but I think it's definitely, you know, it's actually really easy to develop a queer normative world. And when you represent one, I think you realize how easy it could be in the real life. You're like, huh, this actually isn't that difficult. Like if we all just came together, I'm hopeful. So I think that is, you know, a way of education, I guess, you know, by showing something so simple. I think there's like a really throwaway line, like there's trans characters throughout, there are queer characters throughout, but there's a throwaway line where it's like mustaches were in, or was it beards were in fashion, and Letel was like, one year she just decided, oh, she wanted one. And I didn't even, it didn't even occur to me to not have a woman try and have a beard. You know, it just, for me, it was showing how easy it could be to not have those kind of gender constraints. And so, yeah, I think it is really important to have elements like that where you can. I also recognize that it's not necessarily fantasy's job to fix the world. So I don't go out of my way to go, this is a political statement that I'm trying to make. I just do what I want to do. And if that manages to change some people's minds, then amazing.
Absolutely. You sort of incorporate it where you can. Yeah. And I do think it is helpful, I think, for some readers, right, where it's sort of in a, you know, a fantastical setting, just so that they look at it in a different way.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, you did say you are currently writing Feybound 2. Is that right?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So again, in publishing, we're always like on to the next before this is even out. But is there anything you're allowed to talk about or share about the process? We at least know we're getting more books.
Yes, it's a trilogy. And there will be a Fury point of view, which I'm very excited about. I haven't written that yet, but that's going to be there. Other than that, you're just going to have to wait and see, I guess.
Yes. I know, it's so funny. And so I always ask authors this question, and obviously you're only allowed to say so much. The first book isn't even out yet. But you said a Fury point of view, and my mouth just like was on the floor. So I think readers and listeners will be very eagerly anticipating, you know, this book and then the subsequent books in the trilogy.
Yes, I'm very excited.
So a little bit of a little bit of a shift, but Feybound related. You are doing some really fun book tour events in 2024, the Feybound Ball in London. That looks like an incredible time.
I know, it's next week. It's kind of wild. I still haven't got my outfit sorted, but I'm going to. It was quite funny. Me and my publicist sat down and I was like, should we do something just like really fun and crazy? And she was like, yeah, what? And I was like, I don't know. I was like, maybe like, what about like a fey ball? And then as soon as I said it, I was like, no, that's silly. And she was like, no, let's do it. And so we've got this amazing venue, got so many fairy lights, got like glitter makeup artists coming. I'm very excited.
It sounds fantastic. I love that you just like, you're leaning into it and just going all out for this event. It sounds you know, like a real treat for the readers as well.
Yeah, it was amazing. And I'm so lucky that just the book community is just the best. And it sold out in like 4 hours. And then we were trying to find a bigger venue, but it was just like just before Christmas. And we're like, there's nowhere, we can't book anything. So we've been very lucky.
It's really exciting. And so is there anything, we're like barely into 2024, but Feybound comes out in just over a week's time in the UK and a little bit longer than that in the US. What are you sort of most looking forward to in 2024?
So I will be completing the Final Strife trilogy, so the Ending Fire trilogy. So that's coming out in August. So yeah, I've got a double whammy year, which is really amazing. I'm really excited for Feybound to come out. I just can't wait to see it in a bookstore. That would be really exciting. I'm also, so I've got another book I'm writing this year, which is my historical fiction debut, which is Cleopatra. And that's out next year. And I'm doing a research trip to Egypt, which will be amazing. So I'm very much looking forward to that. But yeah, by the end of this year, I need to have written 3 more books. So I'm very busy.
Extremely busy, but a lot to look forward to, I think. And starting off the year on a really good foot.
Yeah, no, I'm just so lucky to do what I do.
Well, we're lucky. I'm like, we're as a reader, I feel very lucky to have read this book.
Oh, thank you.
And so as we sort of wrap up the conversation, is there anything that you would want readers to take away from the story in Feybound?
I just want them to finish the book with a smile. I have had a few readers actually finish the book crying, which I was a bit concerned about. I was like, it's okay, everything's going to be fine. But I just want people to go all in with the world and just immerse yourself and just come out with a smile. And that for me is the main thing. And that, you know, I will have made that, yeah, that just makes my day, you know, just making readers happy or cry, you know, I will take tears. But yeah, I think that's the main thing.
And I think the ending could elicit either a smile or tears or both.
Yeah, 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 I do see that.
Absolutely. And so for our listeners, what is the best place for them to find you online to make sure that they're up to date with everything that's going on?
So I'm on Instagram at Sara El Arifi, Twitter, but updates only at Sara El Arifi. I have a website, which is saraelarifi.com, and I'm on TikTok, which is also Sara El Arifi.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about Feybound. It's been such a delight getting to know more about you and this book.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been such a pleasure.
Readers can sample and borrow the titles mentioned in today's episode on overdrive.com, and our library friends can purchase these titles in Marketplace. Professional Book Nerds is proud to be an Evergreen Podcast signature program. To learn about other Evergreen podcasts, visit evergreenpodcasts.com. Our podcast is produced, recorded, and edited by Emma Dwyer and Joe Skelly, and presented by Overdrive. To learn more, visit professionalbooknerds.com.
Bonjour, this is Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. I'm Andrew Pryor, and every week I bring you the wonderful and fabulous people involved in French food, whether they're here in France like me or from around the world. Each week, we dive into a specific topic, be it a French dish, an ingredient, or a French cuisine cooking technique. My guests are all about French food, so come join me on Fabulously Delicious, the French food podcast. Bon app.